Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
It's time to talk about all things racing. NASCAR, IndyCar, sports cars, and Formula One. This is the Final Inspection Show, presented by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove. Now, here's your host, Steve Saake.
Welcome back to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove, along with our friends at David Hobbs Honda. Joining me once again, of course, is the Polish Python, Jeff Orlowski. And let's go through our predictions here. So we got Talladega this weekend. You got the Xfinity race. And I think Dennis said pick a Kyle Busch or a Joe Gibbs car. So I guess that would be what? Either Harrison Burton or Brandon Jones. In fact, we'll give him both. And then he took Kevin Harvick in the cup race. Jeff, what about you? What do you think in the Xfinity race?
Xfinity race, I'm going to go with a guy that not a lot of people, I'm sure, are picking. Give me Fast Pasta, Anthony Alfredo.
You know, I was looking at him. He's been running pretty good lately. You know, he's been getting a few top fives here and there. He's had some issues off and on a couple races, some bad luck, but I don't think that's a bad pick. It's a longer shot, but I would definitely think he's a top seven pick.
Yeah, he's having one hell of a year, and he's had good speed most weeks. So, you know, I think, you know, if there's ever a throw darts at the wall and pick a winner, I think Fast Pasta might get lucky today.
All right, and then what about tomorrow in the cup race?
Tomorrow in the cup race, I'm going to go with the Polish Prince. Give me big, bad Brad Keselowski.
Brad K. Okay, I was looking at that one. I'm going to go with Justin Allgaier. I'm going to pick chalk. Justin Allgaier in the Xfinity race. Cup race, give me Kyle Busch. He has to win sooner or later, right? So I think I like him. Either him, but of course you can't go wrong with the Hamlin or Harvick duel, who's been just pretty much winning everything else. So if you're a betting guy, go with those two. But I just have a feeling about Kyle Busch in this one. Jeff, we certainly appreciate you taking time out, and always a pleasure chatting with you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to John Horowitz, who with his latest book on PacWest Racing, of course, one of the dominant teams in the old kart era in the 1990s and early 2000s, and also get a report of what's happened down at Indianapolis this weekend. Of course, we got the Harvest Grand Prix. They had a rare Friday afternoon race yesterday, and of course, they are racing today. So we'll get a live update from John coming up next on the Final Inspection Show. Welcome back to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove, along with our friends at David Hobbs Honda. And joining us on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline, it is John Horowitz, longtime member of the IndyCar scene, going back to the kart days of the late 1990s, and of course, coming out with a new book, neat book, PacWest Racing's Rise and Fall. Pretty neat book, which celebrates kind of time flies, I should say, the history of PacWest Racing. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you joining us. And PacWest Racing, of course, is that's where Scott Dixon got his start. A lot of people might not remember that, but Scott Dixon was an up and coming driver, was the youngest winner, if I recall, in Neil Kart Circuit when he won at Nazareth way back when, wasn't it?
He did set that record, and you know, long time fans of the sport might remember when Dixon came over here in 1999. He was 18 years old, and he actually looked a lot like Paul Tracy at that age. He was kind of pudgy,
yes,
with, you know, ginger complexion, and he drove a year of Indy Lights over here for Stefan Johansson's team, and Stefan ended up taking over as his manager, and remains his manager to this day, in fact. And Johansson kind of negotiated a deal for him to join PacWest in for the 2000 season, and he was teamed with Tony Renna at PacWest to run Indy Lights, and he had a really successful season. There was kind of a unspoken real with PacWest's IndyCar team in the kart series. Mauricio Guzman and Mark Blundell were in their late 30s, kind of in the twilight of their career, and the team wasn't really achieving a lot of results on the IndyCar side, and they knew that there was a possibility for one or both of them possibly to move up, and Dixon pretty comprehensively showed that he was the guy in 2000. He won six races in the Indy Lights Championship. I believe his main competition that year was Townsend Bell. And then he got promoted to the kart series in 2001, and PacWest kind of recovered from the difficulties they had in the late 90s when the Mercedes Ilmor engine program wasn't competitive or reliable, and they had Toyota engines in 2001, and as you point out, it was a pretty circumstantial win at Nazareth. Dixon was only making his third start in IndyCars. He qualified near the back, and it was a fuel mileage race, but it's interesting that even at that point in his career, when he wasn't even 21 years old yet, he was mature enough to manage a race that way. And it's kind of become a hallmark of him. He's won, you know, he won one race for PacWest, and he's won 49 races now for Chip Ganassi. And he's closing in on Mario Andretti on the all-time win list. And it's kind of mystifying to see the slump that he's been in here for the last couple of races. And it'll be interesting to see whether he can snap out of it today.
And this is a kind of interesting book. I'm looking forward to reading it because it has a definite insider's look, because you worked for PacWest Racing as a PR rep, and you know, seeing that side of it, you certainly see a difference, especially with the amount of time you're with the drivers, and back then too, the media in certain ways was a lot bigger in certain ways, I think, and to kind of walk us through that, how that really changed, and what you initially thought when you finally got to the other side of the pit wall, so to speak, on that side of racing.
Well, there's no question that the kart series, up to the split with the Indy Racing League when Tony George branched off and created some conflict that I think a lot of people thought was unnecessary, the kart series was flying high in the 90s. You had Nigel Mansell racing here in 93 and 94. You had the emergence of Jacques Villeneuve, who went on to become a Formula One world champion. The kart series was really doing well in the mid-90s. With a ton of international attention and a ton of national and international media. I got my start working in the media. I owe a lot of my career to Nigel Mansell in the sense that I got involved in 1993, and the English media was desperate for content from Nigel Mansell, so I got to cover Nigel Mansell's first couple years over here. But by the time 97 came around, I was in a position where I had to, quote-unquote, get a job, start pulling my weight. And so I got a job with PacWest as the PR guy. And I honestly, if I'm truthful, I didn't really know what I was doing for the first half of the season. I always set out to be a journalist, and I kind of achieved my dream, but in a very small time way. And going to work for PacWest, I did it for 2 years. It ended up being great for my career, because when I went back into the media in 1999, it was at a much higher level, and I was able to come in as the kart series correspondent for National Speed Sport News and do some work for Kart's independent website. The PacWest years were fascinating for me. It was just so educational to learn about how a racing team works, and just you know, I always thought of it as a sport. And of course I've grown up and realized that it's really a business, and that's kind of unfortunate in some ways and good in others. But the 2 years at PacWest, it really gave me an insight into how teams work, how drivers work, having known what the media looked for, it was interesting to try to service that side. I mean, I didn't get a whole lot of satisfaction out of writing press releases or pitching stories. I wanted to actually write the stories, which is ultimately why I went back into the press. But unbelievably invaluable experience, some really, really good times, especially doing functions with the drivers. I mean, if you get to spend a week with Mauricio Gugelmann in Brazil and he wins pole position for his home race, there's a lot of excitement that goes around it, and a lot of it was unexpected. I mean, I honestly, when I went there, I didn't think PacWest had run that great. I saw a couple of guys who in Formula One, and I understand that Formula One is very dictated by the cars that people drive, but I saw a couple guys that were midfielders in Formula One. Mm-hmm. But when they got over here and when they got the right package in 1997 with the right engine and the right tires and the right chassis and the right engineers, suddenly these guys were capable of winning races. And, you know, PacWest doesn't have the pedigree or the heritage of Penske or Ganassi or Newman Haas, but at the same time, it's kind of unique in the sense that Bruce McCall was one of the first outsiders from outside of racing who came in and tried to make a go of it as a business, and ultimately that failed. But I don't think it was really down to the team itself. It was down to the circumstances and some of the decisions they made. They were too loyal to the Mercedes engine program, and ultimately that's one of the two or three key factors that put them out of business at the end of 2001.
I do have to ask you this, since you brought up Brazil and that, and it came up in conversation just a week or two ago with a bunch of buddies. We were chatting, and the subject of Mark Blundell came up and that scary crash he had at Brazil. And this is a time before Hans devices and software barriers, where he had, if I recall, it was a throttle stuck as he was coming into turns 3 and 4 at a very, very scary, and one of the hardest hits I've ever seen in an Indy car. And you know, when that happened, we were thinking the worst. I remember I was watching it with a bunch of guys, and it was a scary, scary crash. Kind of, can you give us a little background on that, or do you have any background on that crash and Blundell and on that?
Well, I do. That was in 1996. It was the first year that they raced it at Rio at the so-called, Rick Mears actually called it a roval. He was the first guy to bring that word into the lexicon, because the track was actually a trapezoid-shaped track that had two short straights, two long straights, but it was opposite symmetrical at each end. In other words, the radius of turn one and two was the same as 3 and 4, but just in opposite. And the result of it is that the guys had to brake pretty hard going into one, and they had to brake even harder going into four. And Blundell actually suffered total brake failure going into turn four. The problem, and we actually document this with a pretty significant sidebar in the book, a PacWest, or I should say a Galmer engineered part failed, and it hadn't been proper. We kind of go through that whole thing. And, you know, not just that, but the emotional toll that something like that, when a project that you initiate ends up not working and puts a guy in the hospital. It was a scary crash. Mark was sidelined for a couple races, and it did lead to some changes in the sense that PacWest ended their relationship with Galmer and took engineering operations under their own roof in Indianapolis under the head of a guy called Alan McDonald, who IndyCar fans might recognize as an engineer that's been with Team Green and Ray. I think he's with Ray Halls now. So it led to changes within the team. But the other thing it did is it really spurred development of a soft wall. The next year in Brazil, it was essentially like a tire barrier at a road course or a street course, and it was kind of banded together by this conveyor belt-like material. And it's kind of ironic that Gugelmann was the first guy to test it in the race in 97, because he had a gearbox failure and he crashed. And he said it was like sitting down in a chair the first time that he crashed into a soft wall. Now, that particular application didn't work, because they found the following year it going to, you know, with the rubber band effect getting pitched back onto the track. But it was an important step in the development of But and it's ironic because I'm sitting out here at the roundabout outside turn one of Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and the speedway was just so developmental, instrumental, in creating this. Went into operation in 2002, and I think every oval racer around the world owes a debt of gratitude to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and NASCAR for their part in funding it, and of course Dr. Dean Sicking and the University of Nebraska team that actually did the research and came up with this life-saving device, which is between the Safer Barrier and the Hans device that protects drivers from basal skull fracture. Those are by far the two most important safety advances of the 21st century.
Totally agree on that. We're talking with John Orovitz on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline. His new book, Time Flies, A History of PacWest Racing, available online. We'll get to that in just a moment. But like you said, you're at the Harvest Grand Prix this weekend, and you had a rare Friday race. Which, well, but let's face it, because of the COVID-19 epidemic, IndyCar has to fill out the schedule, and they kind of did the doubleheader with a Friday-Saturday race. I was, kind of tongue-in-cheek saying it's probably going to be the lowest-rated IndyCar race ever because it was held on a Friday afternoon on the USA Network. But a very entertaining race, and since they redid that oval at Indianapolis, and I think they did the right thing by getting the driver's input on how to properly maybe do to reconfigure the racetrack or tweak it as they did from when it was a Formula One track. It certainly has become a racier, and then yesterday I thought was a pretty entertaining race. And what can we expect today at the Harvest Grand Prix, John?
I think we're looking at another struggling day for Scott Dixon, who didn't qualify very well again. He's fortunate in the respect that Joseph Newgarden only qualified as well. But these guys are going to try to make chicken salad out of something else today when they're starting that far back in the midfield. Mm-hmm. Dixon's his goal very simply has to be to finish ahead of Newgarden. If he can simply achieve that goal, I think he makes Joseph's possibilities of taking the championship at St. Pete pretty much impossible. But at the same time, Scott's starting 15th or 16th, I forget which. This is 75 laps instead of 85 laps, and so most people should pretty comfortably be able to do it on this. Yesterday there was definitely a lot of strategy options. So it's. I think we're looking at a track position day, and Dixon, and I think Newgarden will probably play it pretty conservative. I think Dixon, from where he's at, I think he can afford to gamble more and be one of the guys that maybe goes off strategy and stops early. It's been strange to see the number nine team kind of off game the last three or four races, really since the first race at St. Louis. Scott spun at Mid-Ohio, which is an unforced error. He had another unforced error in yesterday's race that cost him a couple positions, and that's pretty uncharacteristic for him. And it just shows the amount of pressure and the tension that goes into these championship battles, and especially when a guy like Joseph Newgarden and a quality team like Penske gets a little momentum on their side, they can really run with it. So Dixon's mission today is to kind of stop the bleeding. If he can't finish ahead of Newgarden, he needs to finish within two, three, four positions of him, and at least have a 25 or 30 point cushion going into the race at St. Pete, where anything other than a back of the field finish should guarantee him the championship.
Well, John, we lost you there for a second. We're talking with John Orovitz with his book, The History of PacWest Racing. And, John, if you can hear me, what's the easiest way to get that book?
Well, I wish I could say there was a super easy way. If you go to my website, johnorovitz.com, I'm trying to re-engineer my website and get a direct link up right now. You can leave a comment on there and with your email address or whatever, and I'd be glad to get back to you. It is available through retail outlets. You can get it through Motorsport Collector in Northern Illinois. You can get it through Coastal 181. Racer Magazine is having a promotion on it right now. it's nice if you order direct from me because it lines my pocket with a little bit more cash, which is always appreciated. And as a benefit, if you order direct from me, and again, just my first name and last name at comcast.net if you want to reach out to me directly. But I do have book plates, custom-made book plates for the books signed by Bruce McCaw that I'd be glad to sign as well. It's always a nice
bonus. Oh, excellent. Yeah, very good. Well, we will post that on our Facebook site and put that up later today on how to get the book. And, John, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. How's the weather down there today at Indianapolis?
It's funny. My girlfriend was just complaining that it's a little bit too warm. Actually, to me, it's actually perfect for what's being billed as the Harvest Grand Prix. It's 60 degrees. You know, partly sunny, partly cloudy. It's a crisp fall day. It's the kind of day where I'm going to go watch a car race, drink a couple beers, and then go home and make a fire in the fire pit.
Excellent. Well, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. And like I said, make sure you get that Time Flies, A History of PacWest Racing, a very interesting book and an interesting time in open wheel racing. Make sure you get that. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Larry Janicek and have three questions with Larry coming up next on the Final Inspection Show. To the Final Inspection Show, Steve Zottke, along with joining me on the Great Midwest Bank Hotline from fashionable Pewaukee, Wisconsin. It is Larry Janicek. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Hello, Steve. Nice to talk with you again.
Yes, it certainly has. We missed you last week, but that was because of a scheduling conflict. But we certainly appreciate you taking time out. So what do we have for this week?
I'd like to mention for your listeners that have MAV TV that tomorrow at 2:00 live on MAV TV are the ARCA stock cars from the Mile Dirt Track at Springfield, Illinois. Kind of a neat deal.
One of my favorite events, yes, and love that. And of course, our friend Jim Tradel, of course, will be on doing that.
Oh, great.
So
Steve. Recently, it was announced that Sebastian Bourdais is going to drive for A.J. Foyt next year, and actually he's racing a Foyt car this weekend in Indianapolis. I wonder, do you remember who won the last race, what driver did for an A.J. Foyt Indy, for the A.J. Foyt IndyCar team, the last race that was won for them?
Yes, that was Takuma Sato at Long Beach Grand Prix, where I was happily at that race.
You know, I kind of thought maybe you were. I knew you went there a few times.
And then,
yeah, that was in 2013.
2013, then you have to go back to 2002, prior to that, where I believe it was Ayrton Daré at Kansas.
There's a name from the past.
Isn't that?
That is crazy.
Ayrton Daré, so.
Okay, then next question. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, because AJ had a good run in the IRL with Kenny Breck and Billy Boat, among others, that won races for him. And then Daré came in 2002 was the last win. And then, yeah, you got to go to Takuma Sato. What they're trying to do, obviously, Foyt with their engineering side is falling behind once again. And you know, we've said this before in the past, you know, the biggest... even with Andretti Autosport at the beginning of the year, had that slip up, and it's so easy to fall behind in the IndyCar series in the engineering side. And the biggest way you can really kind of make advances, and one of the few places where you can, because you know, with the spec cars and you know, NASCAR and IndyCar, you're trying to control costs, but in a way, you drive up costs when you're so limited on what you can do with some of these cars, and that's on the shock side. So shock development is very, very important, and that's the one thing, obviously, you can see with the results. A.J. Foyt Racing last probably year and a half, 2 years, has not done well, even though Tony Kanaan did get a podium last year. But with Bourdais coming on this year, it kind of gives them a head start with what they want to do for it next year with Foyt Racing.
Sounds good. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the 1970s, 10 years of IndyCar racing at that time. And I'd like to just talk a little bit today about the 1960s. Can you list the most Champ Car wins by drivers during that 10-year period in the 1960s?
My guess would be there should be three. I think it would go Foyt, Andretti, and then maybe Roger Ward would be in there. Cause I know Roger Ward won a bunch of one bunch. Not only, you know, like the 62 Indy 500, he won a few races at the Milwaukee Mile, but early in the 60s, Roger Ward was quite the powerful at the fairground tracks, like at DuCoin and Springfield, won a bunch of them, and then Foyt kind of took over that crown. And then Andretti, though, too, won a bunch of races on the dirt, too. So the three of those guys really kind of padded their score, so to speak, on tracks such as Hoosier 100, Springfield, and DuCoin.
Well, you're as hot as a firecracker today because you got those top three guys nailed. So just to throw in, gotten an idea who might be fourth. So Foyt had 42, Mario had 29, Roger Ward had 15, and this next person had 10 in the 1960s.
Oh, boy. It'll probably be one of those. Oh, yeah, it makes sense now. 10. I might need a hint.
Brotherly love. You just got to figure out which brother it is.
Okay, is it Al Unser then?
Yep. Al had 10. John Cock had 7. Branson had 7. And Bobby Unser had 7. But you nailed those first three right away.
Yeah, because Al dominated the 1970 season, but I've always said that really kind of kicked off at Milwaukee at the Bettenhausen 200. Donald Davidson likes to say the Tony Bettenhausen 200, which is a 200-mile race held in August at Milwaukee, you could kind of say the favorite for Indianapolis the following year, especially if they stayed with the same team, would be the winner of that race, because that happened so many times, whether it's Pat Flaherty, Jim Rathman, I think, Roger Ward, among others, and Al Unser was certainly one of them, too. Al broke his ankle at Indianapolis screwing around on a little motorcycle during a rain delay. Was knocked out for about a month, and when he came back, Mario Andretti dominated the beginning of the year, and of course winning the Indianapolis 500. But when it came to the end of August, and that year I think they had 30 races on the schedule, Al really dominated the last third of that season, and really going into 1970 was hot when they painted the car in the Johnny Lightning colors and just dominated in the 70 season, won the championship there. But yeah, it was he won a bunch of races towards the end of 70. So
you got that right on the head. Okay, next question. About 3-4 weeks ago, there was a really interesting F1 race because Mercedes-Benz, Red Bull, or Ferrari was not the winning car. You have any idea when that previously happened? When was the last time that a Ferrari, Red Bull car, or a Mercedes-Benz won or didn't win, excuse me?
Does it go back to Vettel and a Toro Rosso team at Monza?
It was in
10 years prior?
Austria 2013. It was 146 Grand Prix in a row.
Oh, it wasn't Ligier. Let's see, who would that been? I give up.
No, I didn't have the driver's name. I just wanted to. It was 146 Grand Prix before, and it was in Austria in 2013, or Australia, excuse me.
Australia.
No, Austria. I'm sorry.
It is Austria.
Yeah.
Austrian GP.
Yeah, that's quite a while ago.
I do not look these up on just so you know, but I am looking up this one.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Who won 2013 is... It was not held. Wait a second. Are you sure it wasn't Australia?
I don't know. I just got the abbreviated AUST.
Yeah, it's Australia then. Australian.
Sorry for this.
Yeah, this is good radio when you're looking stuff up online.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Probably wasn't the most clear question.
Oh, give me one more question while I look this up.
Okay, there's been 14 drivers that have won both a NASCAR Cup Series race and a Champ Car IndyCar race. 14 guys. How many of them do you think you can name?
Oh, boy. And if you're wondering, it's Kimi Räikkönen won a Lotus Renault in 2013.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
So I forgot about that, yeah.
I would not have guessed that.
Yeah.
146 races.
That's interesting. I would not have guessed that. It would have been a lot of dead air on the radio for me to guess that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got Cup and IndyCar winners, correct?
Yep.
All right. Well, you got to go with, let's see. Foyt's the easy one. Mario's an easy one. You would have Dan Gurney. Montoya, of course. And let's see. This is where it gets a little more difficult now. It's probably some newer people.
Actually, there's some older ones, too, in the 60s. And 90s.
Yeah, I'm just having a brain fart now. Because I'm thinking of guys like... Because I just watched the 86 Watkins Glen, and I've totally had forgotten Al Unser. That was his last Winston Cup start. He subbed for Buddy Baker in that Crisco.
Oh, wow.
Oldsmobile. Yeah, totally had forgotten about that. So now I'm just have visions of Al Unser in my head. Guys that won both. See, I think they race both. I mean, I'm thinking Tim Richmond, but Tim Richmond never won an IndyCar race.
Right.
Bobby Unser never won a NASCAR race. In fact, Bobby Unser only raced one Winston Cup race. That was the 69 wow. Daytona 500. Yep. Al Unser, though, raced a few, but never won. Jim Herdebees. How can I forget Jim Herdebees?
Right, yeah.
Jim Herdebees is one. Yeah, he won the 66 Atlanta race.
Yeah, 66 Atlanta, right. I was at Atlanta in 65 for the Indy cars.
So here
you go if you want me to run through the list.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, you get Foyt, Gurney, Parnelli, Robbie Gordon, John Andretti, Montoya, Mario, Allmendinger, Mark Donahue, Herdebees, Johnny Mance, Johnny Rutherford.
Ooh.
And they actually counted that.
Yes, the 100 miler.
Yes, at Daytona. Race. Chuck Stevenson and Tony Stewart.
Chuck Stevenson, that's interesting.
Yeah, I was really surprised at that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe they might have counted.
He probably switched over because he had actually retired from AAA, and I wonder if he did some stock car racing maybe to pay the bills or something. For those who don't remember, Chuck Stevenson, very underrated driver, raced Indy cars, came up through the sprint car ranks and whatnot in the 50s, won the first paved IndyCar race at the Milwaukee Mile, but not only that, but also won the last dirt race at Milwaukee, and actually lived in Milwaukee for a few years.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I knew about the
he did
the last and first, but I never realized he lived there.
His son is still around, Chuck Stevenson Jr., and loves the blues and bluegrass as a guitarist.
Oh, wow. That's a good combination.
Yeah, so, but interesting, Johnny Rutherford, raced in the Daytona 500 before he actually raced in the Indianapolis 500. That's a bit of trivia, too. So, all right, well, Larry, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. All this good stuff, all this fun going in the Wayback Machine. And I did not think I would mention Kimi Räikkönen and Lotus Renault
in the show today.
But we were able to do that. That's one of the reasons why you're on the show. But, Larry, thanks again. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll chat again next week.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Take care.
All right, coming up next, we're going to talk with from RacingNation.com, Fast Eddie Lapine. So we got some news, of course, in the world of road racing in Formula One and IMSA. Coming up next on the Final Inspection Show. Welcome back to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove, along with our friends at David Hobbs Honda. Joining us on the Great Midwest Race, on the Midwest Bank Hotline from RacingNation.com, it is Eddie Lapine. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, guys. How are you? I was sitting in my car trying to push the button to answer the question on Jeopardy. I knew it was going to be right 5 minutes earlier.
Did you? I totally forgot about that.
I couldn't. I was like, is this frustrating or what? I could have won Jeopardy today. Well, next time, I'm going to call in with a trivia question. But basically, my stuff in a nutshell today is the bombshell that hit with Honda pulling out of Formula One. As we wrote in Racing Nation a while back, I'm going to post the story again about the situation of F1 right now and the status of it. And it's very mind-blowing what's going on now in racing. And I think the pandemic has really expedited the exit of a lot of manufacturers in racing right now. And I think that's the big problem. They're looking at budgets and stuff, and that's why you're seeing Porsche pulling out of IMSA at the end of the year. Mazda was the latest announcement, going to one car for next year. And the big bombshell, which I think is really huge, is Honda pulling out of Formula One. It's four cars that are affected by that, and Christian Horner's he said he had a backup plan already in the works, but I still think that that's really huge when you only have a handful of manufacturers in this Formula One day and age. When we go back to what I said 5 years ago about Formula E and all the manufacturers getting involved in that, we can see that they're exiting to go to that now, with electric being a mainstream thing now across the world. I thought it was interesting
with the Honda announcement that they have committed on delivering a new power plant for next year for the Red Bull team and AlphaTauri in 2021. Now, obviously, they haven't said, they didn't decide to go, well, let's quit Formula One, but let's come out with a new engine. This engine's been in the works for a while. And it, like what you said, Eddie, the development and everything of this new engine for 2021, and then you got the pandemic and all the costs associated with this, there has to be that work. Especially when you understand how much money Mercedes has been hemorrhaging to win these world championships, Honda has to say, enough is enough. Let's this is it now. We'll come up with this engine. Their goal is to win the world championship next year. I don't know how that's going to happen with Mercedes, being a 900 pound gorilla in Formula One, but you know they're going to step back. And this isn't the first time they've done this. They did this in the 60s. They did this in the 90s too, where they were involved as an engine manufacturer in the 90s with McLaren too. So it'll be interesting to see how this happens. And then also, Eddie, with Mercedes or with Mazda, I think it's actually kind of a win for IMSA with them just only cutting back to one car, because I think you and I were speculating they might pull out entirely.
Well, totally, and I think that's the problem that's happening now. I mean, these car manufacturers are looking at overall budgets, and if you're not selling cars and you can't get cars to sell, it's going to affect motorsports. And you're seeing it in all forms of motorsports now. And unfortunately, I think, you know, this is going to be detrimental to motorsports. You're seeing it. And so we're going to have to...
Eddie, we certainly appreciate you taking time out. And make sure you check out Eddie's stuff at racingnation.com. Good stuff as always. And we'll talk to you next week, Eddie. Thanks for joining the show. You've been listening to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by Great Lakes Dragway and David Hobbs Honda. Here in my car, I know I'm starting to think about leaving tonight, although nothing seems right in cars.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.